The headlines: Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei says those responsible for Wednesday's deadly terrorist attack on an Iranian shrine will receive punishment for the crime. Israeli forces fatally shoot two Palestinians and seriously injure another at a checkpoint near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. And South Korea says North Korea has fired two ballistic missiles into the Korean Peninsula waters 4 days after the two exchanged warning shots. Hello and welcome. Your world news coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi. Iran's leader says those responsible for the terrorist attack on a holy shrine in the southern city of Shiraz will undoubtedly be punished for what they've done. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei said firm action must be taken to identify and tackle the root cause of such heinous crimes. The leader said that all people and entities in the country are responsible in the face of seditious acts by the enemy and the traitorous or ignorant shootings. He also advised everyone to stay united against those who are undermining the security and disrespecting sanctities. Separately, Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi said recent riots in the country have paved the way for the terrorist attack in Shiraz.
These riots paved the way for terrorist attacks. They came to Shah Cheragh Mausoleum and sprayed with bullets innocent people who were worshipping God. The ground for such terrorist attacks was prepared by riots.
Raisi also said the riots have their roots in the fact that Iran's adversaries have failed to disrupt its progress through other means. He said the enemies don't want Iran to develop and prosper. The attack on the holy shrine of Shah Cheragh left at least 15 people dead, including women and children. Over 24 people have also been injured. The Daesh Takfiri terrorist group has claimed responsibility. Officials say the 30-year-old assailant has been wounded and is now in custody. 3 days of public mourning have been announced in Fars province. The chairman of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajari, says a certain process to demonize Iran, that is taking place in normalizing the use of violence against supporters of the Islamic Republic.
The Iranian nation, who has been target of terrorism from the time of the revolution and target of atrocities being committed by Saddam or by others, Iran has been targeted over and over, and we are facing right now a situation that the demonization process which is taking place against Iran day in, day out, it really is unprecedented, and it does lead to violence being unleashed, not just in Iran but elsewhere. I mean, we saw in streets of Europe, mosques being attacked, sort of people who are gathering for Arbaeen being attacked, people's hijabs being forcibly removed, and even, you know, five police officers being put in hospital with broken bones. And similar thing has happened in France and elsewhere. So really this encouragement of violence against Iran and in some ways Islamophobic nature of it, it's very worrying, and it goes beyond what is happening to Iranians. It actually has got sort of implication for all Muslims, because if Iranian Muslim so-called opposition, if they go and burn Quran, remove people hijab, attack mosque with sort of bottles of beer and wine, then, you know, the racist is a license for racists to come out and unleash their Islamophobia.
The Israeli regime has stepped up attacks against Palestinians across the occupied West Bank. The city of Nablus has been a flashpoint in recent days. Two Palestinians have been killed in the latest flare-up there, 3 days after 5 more lost their lives. Our correspondent Mona Kendall has the details.
The identity of the second Palestinian who was killed by the Israeli forces at the Hawara military checkpoint in Nablus was revealed to 35-year-old Palestinian Ramzi Ziyara from Nablus. The first one was 47 Palestinian Ahmad Abu Rashid. The Israeli military claimed that there were a shooting at the Hawara military checkpoint at the entrance to Nablus city, and the Israeli forces responded, opening fire at a Palestinian vehicle. A number of Palestinians were inside it, and then Palestinian paramedics said that two Palestinians were killed and a third Palestinian was in critical condition. It's not clear. It's the Israeli story. But we have to mention that the three were inside their vehicle at the military checkpoint of Hawara, and the Israeli forces opened fire at this Palestinian vehicle while the three Palestinians were inside it. It's not clear if they intended to carry out an anti-Israeli operation, or as usual, when Israeli soldiers kill Palestinians in cold blood, they would be telling the word that the Israeli forces were responding to attacks by Palestinians. They do not admit in many cases before that it was an assassination, or Israeli forces have mistaken and killed innocent Palestinians in cold blood. We have to say that up till this day, all military checkpoints, the major ones that surround Nablus city, are completely closed, and there are other routes for the Palestinians, but Palestinians have to go through strict searches before entering the Nablus city and the areas also northern the occupied West Bank.
After more than a decade of on and off indirect talks, Lebanon and Israel have signed a U.S.-mediated deal to end their maritime dispute. The agreement will allow Lebanon to exploit its own natural resources. Maram Salih reports.
Lebanon and Israel have finalized a U.S.-brokered deal aimed at resolving a maritime dispute. President Michel Aoun signed a letter on Thursday endorsing the agreement. The final paperwork was submitted to the United Nations in Naqoura, southern Lebanon, concluding a long path of indirect negotiations with the Israeli regime. Separately, the Israeli cabinet, led by Prime Minister Yair Lapid, also approved the agreement. The regime's representative then delivered the signed copy to the UN at the Naqoura point. Hezbollah Secretary General stressed in a brief statement that the deal is a victory for Lebanon's government, people, and resistance. Nasrallah also declared the end of Hezbollah's exceptional mobilization over the maritime dispute, saying the resistance movement had accomplished its mission regarding the issue. The Hezbollah leader said the agreement is not an international treaty.
What happened in Naqoura is not normalization with Israel. This deal is not an international treaty and is not a recognition of Israel. Israel itself has admitted it received no security guarantees.
U.S. Envoy Amos Hochstein, who was with the Lebanese delegation in the southern Lebanese town of Naqoura, had met the top Lebanese officials.
I truly believe and hope that this can be an economic turning point in Lebanon for a new era of investment and continued support to lift up the economy and make sure that whatever arrangements happen, they're done openly, transparently, and making sure that the benefits are felt directly by all the Lebanese people.
Experts believe this agreement would put Lebanon on the map of natural gas exporters. President Michel Aoun stressed in his statement that demarcating the southern maritime border is a technical matter that has no political implications and won't change his country's policy towards the Israeli regime. U.S. President Joe Biden has hailed the maritime border deal as a historic breakthrough. For Lebanon, it unlocks the possibility to exploit its own natural resources at a time when the West is seeking gas suppliers and looking for alternatives to Russian gas. Maryam Saleh, Naqoura, South Lebanon.
North Korea has fired two ballistic missiles off its east coast in the latest in a series of launches in recent weeks. South Korea's military says the missiles were short range. It says that it has stepped up monitoring and security while coordinating with the U.S. The latest launch comes 4 days after Seoul and Pyongyang exchanged warning shots off the West Coast. It also comes as Seoul and South Korea is set to finish 12 days of military drills that included exercises with the U.S. North Korea strongly opposed to these joint drills, saying that they are a rehearsal for an invasion. Pyongyang says its missile launches are in protest against the drills. While tensions are simmering on the Korean Peninsula, the U.S. and the South say that the North is preparing to conduct a new nuclear test on the 17th since 2017. The South Korean civil leaders demand an end to joint U.S.-South Korean military exercises. The two countries have engaged in the largest military drills in 5 years, with more exercises to continue into November. The drills come amid a rise in tensions following North Korea's recent missile tests. Our correspondent Frank Smith reports from Seoul.
South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has been under pressure for his hardline policy against North Korea, as tensions increase amid renewed large-scale military exercises with the U.S. This week, he sought to reassure the National Assembly and the public.
We will strengthen deterrence against North Korea with overwhelming capabilities through combined defense posture between South Korea and the U.S. and the trilateral security cooperation between South Korea, the U.S. and Japan, so that our people can continue their daily lives without worry.
Progressive civil society worries the Korean Peninsula has fallen into crisis, with unification becoming more and more remote. They oppose the military exercises, demanding an end to the drills and a rethinking of South Korea's alliance with the United States.
From the 31st, the South Korean and U.S. forces will conduct the largest ever joint air war exercise in Korea, with 250 Air Force units deployed to strike hundreds of strategic bases in North Korea at the same time. The Korean Peninsula should not be an outpost for American hegemony in the world. This land should not be an American war base.
The U.S.-South Korea drills have continued since the end of August, following North Korea's testing of dozens of ballistic missiles. South Korea this week staged a large-scale amphibious landing drill. North Korea views such military exercises as a rehearsal for invasion. South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol has emphasized the need for the U.S. to show a strong commitment toward extended deterrence, the so-called nuclear umbrella. But that may not be enough, with stronger conservative voices here calling for South Korea to develop its own nuclear weapons. Frank Smith, Seoul.
As the debate heats up over the so-called dirty bomb allegations, the UN's nuclear watchdog says it will launch an independent investigation into Russia's claims next week. Head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Rafael Grossi, says the probe will be done at two Ukrainian sites. He said inspectors would work to detect diversion of nuclear material under safeguards, any undeclared production or processing of nuclear material. Earlier, Moscow accused Kiev of planning to use a radioactive device laced with toxic nuclear material against Russian troops in Ukraine. It also warned that such act could rise the risk of conflict in the world and the region. Kiev and its Western backers, however, denied these allegations, saying that Russia is setting a pretext for using nukes in the war. Russia says it has filed a complaint with the UN Security Council, demanding an international probe into U.S.'s military biological activities in Ukraine. In a statement, the foreign ministry said Moscow has obtained new evidence and material that show Washington is developing biological weapons in Ukraine. The accusation comes amid escalating tensions between Russia and the West. Shortly after the start of the war in Ukraine, Russia accused the U.S. of funding biological research in Ukraine with the aim of spreading deadly infectious agents. Washington and Kiev, however, have denied these claims, with the U.S. calling it pure fabrication. Previously, Russia had also accused the U.S. of secretly carrying out biological experiments in a lab in Georgia. Hard-pressed mortgage holders in the Eurozone receive more bad news as the European Central Bank raises interest rates by 75 basis points. The energy section against Russia continue to backfire. Some economies warn the EU could be heading for a deep recession. Jerome Hughes reports.
Many millions of people living across the 27-nation EU are struggling to survive. Brussels resident Jefferson Araujo has endured two rent increases since March. His landlord says her mortgage is going up and so a further rent hike is needed.
You go to the market, you cannot buy anything anymore because the price is too high. And I'm thinking maybe to leave Brussels because I'm working in a hotel 10 hours a day. Like sometimes I have just one day off a week.
In an attempt to bring down soaring inflation, the European Central Bank, which manages the euro, has announced interest rates are going up by a further 75 basis points. That represents a huge increase for people repaying home loans. The economic outlook could get even worse, the ECB warns. Some EU leaders have warned the ECB that increasing interest rates so aggressively could push the eurozone into a deep recession. Higher rates impede business expansion and employment. Charities fighting social injustice often point out all of those taking the decisions that lead to higher inflation and interest rates are insulated from the impact simply because they are the richest individuals in society. Critics say the EU's move to cut out Russia's cheap gas over the war in Ukraine is backfiring. Despite this, a ninth round of sanctions against Moscow is being prepared. Peace seems to be a dirty word in Western capitals. This as the US weapons and energy sectors make enormous profits, while ordinary EU citizens pay a very high price. Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Path towards enlightenment.
In the name of God, the All-Compassionate, the All-Merciful. Salam and welcome to another episode of our weekly series titled Path Towards Enlightenment, which is an endeavor to make you and us familiar with an easy and fluent explanation of God's final scripture to all mankind, the Noble Quran, that was revealed to the last and greatest of all messengers, Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In our last episode of this series, we completed the explanation of Surah Mujadila. And from this Friday onwards, we embark on explanation of the next surah, that is Surah Hashr, which is number 59 in the serial order of compilation of the Noble Quran. It has 24 ayahs and was revealed in Medina. Its name is derived from the second ayah, which mentions the word Hashr, which does not, however, denote the gathering on the day of resurrection, but it connotes people's gathering for migration. The surah opens and closes with the glorification of God Almighty by all that is in the world of existence. It mainly refers to the collaboration of the Arab hypocrites with the Israeli tribes in Medina against the Muslims, and the banishment of the Jewish tribe of Banu Nadir for its breaking of the agreement with the Prophet. The Almighty Creator says that the joint stratagems of the hypocrites and the rebellious Israelites lead to nothing but their humiliation and defeat. As for the merits of reciting this surah, there are many, including forgiveness of sins and faults. We now invite you to listen to ayahs 1 and 2.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. سبح لله ما في السماوات وما في الأرض وهو العزيز الحكيم هو الذي أخرج الذين كفروا من أهل الكتاب من ديارهم لأول الحشر ما ظننتم أن يخرجوا وظنوا أنهم مانعتهم حصونهم من الله فأتاهم الله من حيث لم يحتسبوا وقذف في قلوبهم الرعب يخربون بيوتهم بأيديهم وأيدي المؤمنين فاعتبروا يا أولي الأبصار.
In the name of God, the All Compassionate, the All Merciful, whatever there is in the heavens and whatever there is in the earth glorifies Allah, and He is the Almighty, the All-Wise. It is He who expelled the faithless belonging to the people of the Book from their homes at the outset of their en masse banishment. You, the Muslims, did not think that they would go out easily in view of their power. And they, the Israelites, thought their fortresses would protect them from Allah. But the wrath of Allah came at them from whence they did not reckon, and He cast terror into their hearts, so that they demolished their houses with their hands and the hands of the faithful. Thus take lesson, O you who have insight. The opening ayah says that whatever exists in the heavens and on the earth glorify the all-wise and almighty creator of the universe, including angels, mankind, plants, and even inanimate things of which we are not aware. Since the wondrous system of the creation of each and every particle reflects divine omniscience, omnipotence, glory, and wisdom. Ayah 2 refers to the three Israelite tribes of Banu Nadir, Banu Qurayza, and Banu Qaynuqa, which centuries earlier had migrated to Arabia in anticipation of the advent of the last and greatest prophet, as had been foretold in their scriptures. When Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, declared his universal mission of Islam by the command of God, and later, following his persecution by the pagan Arabs of Mecca, migrated to the city of Yathrib, which now became famous as Madinatun Nabi, or the City of the Prophet, and simply Medina, these Jewish tribes denied his mission. They, however, made a pact of peaceful coexistence with the Prophet, but soon breached it by collaborating with the Arab hypocrites, and thought that their strong fortresses would protect them from the Muslims. On God's commandment, the Prophet ordered their expulsion from Medina. These Israelite tribes, who at first thought they would safe in their strongly fortified mansions, suddenly felt fear in their hearts and decided to leave by taking away whatever movable property they had, but demolished their homes with their own hands, lest the Muslims take possession of their vacated property. Here, the Arabic word hashr connotes gathering and driving out of their dwellings. These ayahs teach us that, number one, God Almighty created the entire universe, and thus each and everything glorified him in its own peculiar manner. Number two, God always assists those who sincerely beseech him against the plots of the enemies. Number three, those who violate agreements and breach pacts should be decisively confronted so that they do not think of deceiving Muslims again. And number four, we should not be awed by the strength of the enemies, whether hypocrites or disbelievers, and should act with full trust in God. Now let us listen to ayahs 3 and 4 of the same surah.
وَلَوْلَا أَنْ كَتَبَ اللَّهُ عَلَيْهِمُ الْجَلَاءَ لَعَذَّبَهُمْ فِي الدُّنْيَا وَلَهُمْ فِي الْآخِرَةِ عَذَابُ النَّارِ ذَلِكَ بِأَنَّهُمْ شَاقُّوا اللَّهَ وَرَسُولَهُ وَمَنْ يُشَاقِّ اللَّهَ فَإِنَّ اللَّهَ شَدِيدُ الْعِقَابِ.
And if Allah had not ordained banishment for them, He would have surely punished them in this world. And in the hereafter, there is for them the punishment of the fire. That is because they defied Allah and His Prophet. And whoever defies Allah, indeed Allah is severe in retribution. The peaceful departure from Medina of the treacherous Israelite tribes was actually a torment for them for destroying while leaving the magnificent homes they had built. And had they refused expulsion, God would have punished them with a severe affliction. Although there is a greater punishment for such treasonous, unrepentant communities in the hereafter. As Ayah 4 means to say, such is the dire fate in this world and the hereafter of those who disobey God, defy the Prophet, turn away from the truth and justice, and immerse themselves in self-conceit and vanity. From these ayahs we learn that, number one, banishment is the minimum punishment that Islam has ordained for conspirators and seditionists. And number two, expulsion from Medina for these three Israeli tribes was because of their breaching of pacts and their plotting against Muslims, and not for their being non-Muslims. In conclusion of this week's episode of Path Towards Enlightenment, here is Ayah 5 of Surah Hashr.
ما قطعتم من لينة أو تركتموها قائمة على أصولها فبإذن الله وليخزي الفاسقين.
Whatever palm trees you cut down or left standing on their roots, it was by Allah's will, and in order that He may disgrace the transgressors. This ayah refers to the divine commandment to the Prophet to cut down some of the palm trees that were adjacent to the strongholds of the banished Israelite tribes, so that these would not be misused for hiding and carrying attacks on Muslims, although Islam forbids the felling of trees, setting ablaze of farms, and killing of animals, even during military confrontation. This was a further form of disgrace and humiliation for the treacherous tribes. This ayah teaches us the following points. Number one, those trees that are used for sedition, concealment of conspiracies, and ambushing of Muslims can be cut. And number two, we should be alert and vigilant against the stratagems of the enemies and should not give them a chance to cause further harm. Dear listeners, God bless you and goodbye.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Israel's occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law. That's what a UN-appointed commission of inquiry has said. The Rights Commission has called on the UN to end Israel's permanent occupation and urges prosecution of Israeli officials. As expected, Tel Aviv rejected the report as being anti-Semitic. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll discuss the different aspects of the report and examine the role of the International Court of Justice and other international bodies in holding Israel accountable for its crimes against Palestinians. Joining us for tonight's discussion, we have manager at Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto. And also from Vancouver, international coordinator at Samarun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Ms. Charlotte Cates.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Welcome to the program. Let's start off with Ms. Cates in Vancouver. The report by the UN's Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Occupied Palestinian Territory, which in fact will be presented to the General Assembly later in October, accuses Israel of violating international law by making its control over the West Bank permanent and by annexing land claimed by the Palestinians in Jerusalem al-Quds and the West Bank and Syrian land in the Golan Heights. Well, there have been many reports in this regard. In your opinion, what makes this report different?
In a lot of ways, this report isn't necessarily different, because we have seen many very good reports published by many good UN commissions and agencies over the years that establish the incontrovertible fact that the Israeli occupation routinely violates international law. And in fact, I mean, when we look at the entire creation of the Zionist project on the land of Palestine, this is an exercise of colonialism. Colonialism itself is illegal under international law. So it really even goes beyond the 1967 military occupation to the nature of the Zionist settler project itself. It does show, however, is that despite the influence of imperialist states like the United States, Canada, European Union countries, the UK, that there still is a measure of independence, and that the fact is that all of the military, political, and diplomatic support provided for the Zionist project by these states is not able to cover up, obscure, or hide the truth of the matter, which is that the Palestinian cause is a just struggle for justice, liberation, and return, and that on a daily basis, it is Palestinian rights that are being violated by an ongoing, Zionist onslaught of mass imprisonment, extrajudicial killings, occupation, colonization, siege, denial of the right of return, and crimes that go on and on for 74 years.
Farah Sonajim, the report says there are reasonable grounds to conclude that the Israeli occupation of Palestinian territory is unlawful under international law due to its permanence and the Israelis' de facto annexation policies. And, of course, it says that this should not deprive the occupied power of its statehood nor its sovereignty. When will these condemnations go past just being mere platitudes? When will there be action?
Unfortunately, the United Nations is a biased body, and they have not really done anything for the Palestinian cause. They have never, imposed sanctions or passed real resolutions that make real changes and punish and penalize the Zionist war criminal regime and the occupiers of the Holy Land of Palestine. And it's a continuous thing. We've been seeing this for 74 years, and it does not stop. I mean, every month there's some type of aggression. Every few days now, it's more constant now because they feel, there's nobody's gonna punish them. The United Nations is quiet. Most of the international key players are quiet as well, and the ones with the veto power and so on. I mean, few countries are speaking out and putting pressure and supporting the policies, and one of them obviously is the Islamic Republic of Iran. That's why there's a huge campaign to defame them right now and to paint this wrong picture that they're human rights abusers, where they forget about the real human rights abusers is the Zionist regime. How much annexation, how many houses have they stole from Palestinians? And it's been recorded because of this modern technology that we have. How many phones were used to really, you know, highlight these issues of human rights violations. International law is being breached day and night by the Zionist regime. And the thing is, the Zionist regime really just disregards all these bodies because they've never held them really accountable. It's unfortunate, like, even when the International Criminal Court, the ICC, was looking to investigate the Zionist regime for war crimes, the former prime minister of the Zionist regime comes out and says this is a kangaroo court. He says we don't even recognize it. So this is the type of rhetoric, this is the type of language these people have. They think they're above the law, you know, and they have the state of arrogance. And unfortunately, the only way it seems like it works with the Zionist regime is by military ways and military means. And you know, we've seen that things change once the strength of the Palestinian resistance, you know, hits the Zionist regime. We see that now with Gaza, they negotiate differently and they pull back and they retract and they become submissive. You know, even though they have all the type of advanced weapons, but this strong united resistance against the Zionist regime, I think, is the only solution. Because if we want to rely on the United Nations, we've seen they haven't done nothing. How come they have always spoke about these issues, have had condemnations and statements, but we haven't seen any real action? But we see now real action on the issue of Russia and Ukraine. How much sanctions have been imposed against Russia? How many meetings, you know, important and you know, emergency meetings have happened in the United Nations to condemn Russia, to impose all types of restrictions and sanctions against Russia and all its officials and so on? And it's only a conflict less than 1 year. We're talking 74 years of occupation. So, you know, for us as a human rights organization, we don't want to see violence. We don't want to see people dying. We don't want to see, you know, destabilization. But at the end of the day, we have to be logical and we have to look at things, you know, in a realistic way. And the realistic way is that the Zionist regime is only dealt with and things change when resistance is strong.
Charlotte Cates, that's an issue I wanted to bring up later on in the show, but now that Mr. Najem alluded to it, can we try and draw some comparison between the international response to the Ukraine conflict and the seven-decade-old occupation of Palestine? Why hasn't Israel been sanctioned and pressured and shunned by the international community to end its occupation of Palestinians?
Well, I think here it's always really important to talk about who we mean when we say the international community, because by and large, that term is used to mean the imperialist powers that are responsible for creating war, occupation, colonialism, extraction of resources from people around the world. And so the term international community, as if the responsible international community are those who are responsible for the ongoing war crimes and crimes against humanity. And so the reason why we see a difference in these responses and such a clear and striking difference isn't even that these states are hypocritical or that they have double standards. It's that they have interests, and that their interests are in seeing Zionist colonial power extended in occupied Palestine and dividing the Arab people and dividing the people of the region from one another through the presence of this essentially military colonial project of the Zionist state in occupied Palestine. And so in much the same way, we see that the United States is very much pursuing a war by multiple means against Russia and against any other power that it views as a potential challenger to its domination of the extraction of the resources of colonized and formerly colonized people around the world. And so it's no surprise that these imperialist powers are acting in their interests. But that's not the only international community, and that's not the only international community that matters. Obviously, there are a number of states, I mean, including Iran and including Arab states that have not yet conceded to the role of normalization, including resistance forces like we see in Lebanon, and including popular movements and people's movements around the world, both in the global south and the countries that have risen up against colonialism and continue to defend themselves, and in the capitals, the cities, the streets, and the towns of the imperialist powers themselves, that recognize that what is happening in Palestine is, in fact, a grand crime against humanity, and one that is being supported by U.S. imperialism and one that needs to be brought to an end and to be stopped. And so that's why we are seeing a growth in campaigns to boycott and sanction Israel. And that's why instead what we're seeing are these imperialist powers instead trying to criminalize those boycott movements while saying that it is necessary to use sanctions as kind of a weapon of domination and control against countries from Iran to Russia to, you know, really one third of the world are subjected to U.S. sanctions of some form or another. And so it's really necessary to do everything that we can to build up that real international community, that real international community of all of those forces that are involved in resistance to fight back and to stand with the Palestinian people and to stand with the Palestinian resistance for the liberation of Palestine from the river to the sea, because we can't rely on the United Nations. Instead, we have to act and organize.
Farah Sanajim, the Israelis have rejected this report, obviously, calling its commissioners as being anti-Semitic and questioning their legitimacy. They say the report damages the UN's credibility and its human rights mechanisms. Also, U.S. State Department spokesman Ned Price said that Israel is consistently unfairly targeted in the UN system, including in the course of this commission of inquiry. How hypocritical are these responses?
I mean, you know, this is the hypocrisy of the Zionist regime, because it was established on hypocrisy and contradiction. And, you know, this is what they always try to accuse people of, this victim card. Either they play the Holocaust card and try to, you know, play the victim card all the time, so, you know, people can have empathy for them, and you know, they want to justify crimes by looking at crimes that have happened to let's say the Jewish people before, or they play the anti-Semitic card, you know, and play the victim card again, you know, because they run out of cards now. They're in a very weak state right now, the Zionist regime, so they'll just keep throwing these type of cards around, and they don't get nowhere with them. You know what I mean? At the end of the day, they think they're above the law. Like, when we argue with these people all the time and have different discussions and arguments and protests, we see that their mentality truly is that they believe that they are the chosen people, this is their chosen land, and this is their chosen battle. And they're brainwashed in this kind of manner, you know what I mean? And they don't care about international organizations, and they think that, you know, God is assisting them in this all these criminal activities. But at the end of the day, we know that the resistance will enter Palestine. The resistance is strong. And the axis of resistance is more unified and more experienced now than ever in its history. And like Sayyid Khamenei said, the supreme leader of the Iranian government, he said that the solution is for the West Bank to be armed as Gaza, just something similar to Gaza, like the same model. Hopefully that will transfer to West Bank. And we see that right now. There is an ignition, and there is this reviving revolutionary lifestyle happening now, where a lot of youth are rising up and fighting back the Zionist regime, while they think they can just, you know, breach the international laws, go into Palestinian territories as they please, break all these, you know, people's houses and things like that. And you know, we're hopeful. I mean, like us, freedom people are defending the people that are oppressed. We are really honestly hopeful that we're going to see a free Palestine in the near future. And it's unfortunate, this hypocrisy, where they're crying about one controversial case such as Mahsa Amini, and then they leave all the dead people that get killed in Palestine, such as Shirin Abu Akla, and all these people that we see clearly how the Israelis don't even care about any humanity at all. They kill women, they kill kids, they kill mothers, grandmothers, you know, and nobody speaks about them. There's no outrage, there's no huge, you know, Twitter hashtags being trended by all these government officials and all these organizations and all these activists, you know, but they focus on that one case because they want to hurt Iran, because Iran is the main supporter of Palestine, and that's what hurts them. They hate a sovereign Iran and a strong Iran supporting the oppressed resistance of Palestine.
Charlotte Cates, the commission demanded the international system and individual states must act and uphold their obligations under international law. That must begin at this session of the General Assembly with the referral to the International Court of Justice on the legal consequences of Israel's continued occupation. This is, of course, an excerpt of the report from the commission. How can the ICJ have the leeway to intervene when Israel is not a member of the court and rejects its jurisdiction?
Yes, I mean, the ICJ has, of course, ruled before on Israeli crimes in 2004, on the building of the apartheid wall. And of course, at the ICC, in addition to what's happening at the ICJ, at the ICC, what we've seen is that, like, for example, legal organizations that are working to bring Palestinians' complaints to the ICC are being branded by the Zionist regime as terrorist organizations, essentially in retaliation for what they're doing to expose the Israeli occupation. We know that these kinds of agencies and even these courts aren't going to act on their own because they're also not apolitical institutions. So, for example, at the ICC, we've seen an announcement that Ukraine, once again, is being prioritized, whereas Palestine has been waiting for justice at the ICC for a very long time. And in fact, the entire decision to handle their case was viewed as controversial and almost at risk at any time, despite the fact that there is an international recognition of a Palestinian state, however limited and insufficient that is. But that, once again, speaks to the fact that we see justice in the courts and in international arenas when we demand and seek justice in the streets and when the Palestinian resistance is organizing, leading, and fighting back. And that's why it is so important that we participate in actions. On October 29th, there's going to be a march in Brussels to the European Parliament to demand an end to the European Union's complicity in ongoing Zionist war crimes and crimes against humanity through, for example, we see the EU-Israel Association Agreement meeting with Israeli occupation leaders, and even when issuing weak criticisms, providing nothing more than strong, fundamentally diplomatic, military, financial, and political support to the Zionist regime. And so we want to encourage people everywhere that you can to support the Palestinian people in their resistance by taking to the streets, by coming out and marching, and by joining us in Brussels on October 29th to march to the European Parliament at 2 p.m.
Firas Al-Najem, the report focused on a very important issue, and that's the issue of settlements, on how Israel has sustained and advanced its quote-unquote settlement enterprise, including statements made by Israeli officials indicating the intent to maintain permanent control over the land in violation of international law. The report also found that land is often confiscated for military purposes, but then used for settlement construction. What are the Israelis achieving with this land grab policy? Apart from Judaization of Palestinian land, are the Israelis also deliberately sabotaging any prospects of future Palestinian statehood?
Yes, I mean, this is part of their, plan is to weaken the Palestinians and always show them military pieces everywhere in every corner. So, you know, they can never think that they will ever have their own army and their own state and their own strength and sovereignty. This is one of the main focuses of the Zionist regime, because they know that after they get that strength, then they will start to talk about all the human rights abuses for over these years, all the war crimes. Then they will be talking about compensation, bringing back all the refugees from Palestine. So that means their plan would have to fail, and they won't be able to fully control the land the way that they want to. So this is one of their plans, and it will fail. I think the only type of resolutions we can have to put some pressure, obviously, if the United Nations wakes up actually and really wants to implement the laws truly and put some severe sanctions against Israel, maybe they'll retract a little bit and start to pull away from these settlements. Or the other way is obviously the Palestinian resistance and the rockets, because then, you know, at that point, the settlers and occupiers will feel discouraged and feel, you know, fearful that they have to leave that area because the Palestinians want their land back and they're going to fight for it. And well, like we said, we don't want to see no bloodshed. But if that's the only way it is to acquire your land and to liberate your land, then that's the only way. And it's also it's sanctioned in the Charter of Rights under the United Nations. Any occupied nation has the right to resist, right? And as we see right now, the Ukrainians are getting all types of weapons from Canada, from all types of countries, And it's totally legal and it's totally honorable. But then when somebody wants to help the Palestinians, he's a sponsor of terrorism. It's like Iran supports the Palestinian resistance, you know, inside Gaza, and they call them sponsors of terror. You see the hypocrisy and the biased type of actions is unbelievable, you know. But it's all turning on them anyways because we're exposing them. We're going out to these politicians and we're asking them, like, if you're supporting Ukraine and you're so proud of that, why don't you support the Palestinians that have been occupied for 74 years? And if you don't believe that they've been occupied, the United Nations says they're occupied, and now we have, you know, these little statements here and there that you know, confirm that.
All right, that's all the time we have for this show. Thanks to manager of Canadian Defenders for Human Rights, Firas Al-Najm, joining us from Toronto, and international coordinator of Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, Charlotte Cates, joining us from Vancouver. And a special thanks to you for staying with us on tonight's Spotlight.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is Back to Reality.
Back to Reality.
It's the show where we discuss the most topical of topics, the most controversial of controversies, and the most important affairs of affairs.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, everyone. This is Arab English Radio. You're listening to Back to Reality. Well, this is Asma. I have the honor to be your host for today's episode, and here with me I have two very dear guests, Sister Zainab and Sister Bita, and I would love them to introduce themselves.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, Sister Asma, and all the listeners. I'm really happy to be here today. I'm Zainab Sadat, and I have my MA in English Language Teaching, TFL.
So great. And you, Sister Bita?
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. And actually, I have the pleasure to be here today with you too, my dear friends, and also our dear listeners here. It's a big pleasure for me. So I'm Bita, and I'm a medical student at Sheikh Bashir University. And also, I'm here at your service for today's discussion.
Okay. Thank you, both of you, actually. Thank you for being here, and thank you, dear listeners, for being the other side of this discussion. Well, for today, we are going to have something very much interesting. I would like to start it this way. In this world, there are many situations that which people will get to go to wars. And then plenty much of mothers, plenty much of women, children would have to lose their loved ones. These people are going to be either on the right side of the battle or on the wrong side. Leave that wrong side aside, because we're not talking about them. We talk about the right side of a battle in which the warriors, the soldiers, are going to be lost. Now, the death of these people to some nations is pretty much peculiar, you know. They're still, at this age, now that we're living in a modern age, there are plenty much of people who do not know so much about martyrs. They do not give it too much of credit, you know what I mean? They look at it as something pretty much physical. Someone went to a battle, went to a war, and then he's dead. He no longer lives. Yet, we know that in our religion, when we send someone to a war and then they are killed in that battle, we call them martyrs, and they are going to be so valuable and so worthy creatures for us. Now, shall you please tell me your ideas upon the fact that many people do not actually translate the word martyr as the way we translate it. They call it, it's just a suicide machine. It's not just something pretty much sacred or holy, as we call it.
Thank you.
first of all, I want to tell you actually my translation of this word, martyrdom, actually. There is actually a meaning, a special meaning in our religion for this word, and that it tells